It's the band's eighth proper album since their founding in 1994, Garbage. The new record is called Let All That We Imagine Be the Light. Cruising the decades, 100 years of music. Find all of our playlists and on-demand listening at cruisingthedecades.com.
Over 100 years of music history. In the course of just 1 hour, you've been listening to Cruisin' the Decades with Brad Savage. This is the global edition produced for shortwave, FM, and AM stations worldwide on the leading independent community and music radio stations on the planet. This program originates at WAPS-FM, The Summit, in Akron, Ohio, USA. For correspondence or QSL, contact brad@thesummit.fm. Thank you for supporting independent, eclectic radio broadcasting and signals over the air from all corners of planet Earth. One broadcast to an audience of many, simultaneously. A shared listening experience. Radio and 100 years of music. Join us next time for the global edition of Cruisin' the Decades.
you might know with your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. Asthma affects 25 million people nationwide, and every day 10 people die with it, with African American women and children being most at risk. Early warning signs include coughing, especially at night, or with exercise and wheezing. Almost all asthma can be effectively managed with a good action plan. So talk with your doctor today, and for more information, visit aawellnessproject.org.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
All right, so we're here on Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and today I'm interviewing Mark Hurley. Mr. Hurley is speaking in his capacity as the chair of the Immigration Committee of the ABCA. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
All right. So can you introduce yourself and your expertise to the audience?
Yes, I'm Mark Hurley. I'm an immigration attorney with Fox Rothschild in downtown Pittsburgh. I've been practicing immigration law for over 20 years. I am currently the Allegheny County Bar Association Immigration Committee Chair. I'm a co-chair of the Pennsylvania Bar Association Immigration Law Committee. And I have been a past chair of the American Immigration Lawyers Association Pittsburgh chapter. So I'm coming on to represent those agencies today, those immigration law committees.
Yeah, that's really a lot. And it's really cool that you do all that. Can you give a little explanation of what that might look like on the day-to-day?
As a practicing immigration lawyer, I mostly handle business and family immigration. I have in the past handled all aspects of immigration law. Typically, I work with universities, hospital systems, private employers, and also families to navigate the immigration process, which is quite complex, almost as complex as the tax code. Maybe even more complex.
I don't know. I just did my taxes. That was pretty rough. Well, we're here to ask you about mostly student immigration because we are a college radio station. So it seems like international students' visas are in the news pretty much every day. How is the situation right now changed from what it was like 2 years ago when I feel like nobody was talking about this?
It's changed dramatically. We have seen an uptick in a lot of student revocations of visas, SEVIS issues. We have seen attacks on universities by this administration, most notably right now with Harvard University being threatened to not be able to have international students because of funding issues, as far as just discussions as far as what the administration wants them to do. And we've been seeing that increase in the last 2 or 3 months. In the last 2 or 3 weeks, we've been seeing where the students have had their SEVIS terminated and visas revoked for a number of issues that in the past never were an issue.
Yeah, here at Carnegie Mellon, I know we've had none of the students who have had visas revoked have a criminal record or anything. Maybe they have a DUI that they weren't convicted of or got expunged from the record doing a program, or maybe not even that.
We've seen traffic tickets lead to revocations of visas and SEVIS. Traditionally, in the past, if a student had a DUI and was convicted, there were issues with the visa itself. They would revoke the visa, but they would allow the students to continue studies. Now that's no longer the case because they're actually terminating the SEVIS system. So it's definitely increased versus what the Obama administration and Biden administrations had previously done, and even the Trump administration the first time.
So I'm not a lawyer. Can you explain kind of the difference between like the visa system and the SEVIS system?
Well, SEVIS is the student and exchange visitor program that allows the students to actually get into the system. That's what the international office at CMU would do. They would enter and issue the I-20s for the students. The visa itself is granted by the Department of State at the consulate for the international students. So you need both. You need to have an I-20 from the university, and then you need a student visa in order to come to the U.S. and study. In the past, it was never an issue with an individual that had a DUI. They would just remain in the U.S., complete their studies, and then go back. And they might have visa issues at that point, but they were able to continue their studies. With the SEVIS system being revoked, the students can no longer attend university studies. There's some debate amongst immigration lawyers whether they're allowed to or not, whether universities are allowed to or not. But we've actually seen where universities that have re-entered the I-20 into the system, they actually have that canceled by ICE. So ICE just basically takes what this university does. If they issue a new I-20, they just cancel it anyway. So we've seen that in practice. So basically, once the SEVIS is terminated, there's also a question whether individuals can continue with their EADs if they're on OPT. And there's a debate whether you can or not, but we've seen where most universities will say no, and there's issues with that as well.
Is there a legal justification for this? Could the administrations always just decide to revoke SEVIS and visas?
Well, that's a good question, because the law actually reads that the law provides a non-immigrant's conviction and jurisdiction in the United States for a crime of violence for which a sentence of more than 1 year imprisonment may be imposed, and it constitutes a failure to maintain status. So the question is, are these violations crimes of violence up to 1 year imprisonment that's possible? And so far, no.
There's a parking ticket.
Correct. So we've been seeing cases that are not actually convictions. We've seen parking tickets, speeding tickets. We've seen a number of those that have been terminated, even though the law is clear that they should not be. And that's why a lot of attorneys are litigating these in federal courts. There was a recent action in Georgia where I think there were 110 students that were assigned to that, or that had filed with that, a mass action lawsuit against the administration just because of that, and a lot of individualized. And there's a class action here in Pittsburgh that has been filed. So a lot of attorneys are litigating this matter.
So if litigation is successful, would people just be able to return to their studies, or would there still be more needed to figure out after that?
They should be able to just return to their studies, to complete their studies, to fulfill any OPT time that they're allowed, any STEM OPT time that they're allowed, should be able to pursue H-1Bs if they want to do that, or other non-immigrant visas and also immigrant visas. So it basically just corrects the point where they're at the place where they started, allowed to continue with their studies and pursue any additional action later down the line.
Yeah. So, and then how long does litigation take? Like, this seems like it's going to take years out of people's lives.
It could be, yes. It could be years. I'm not a litigator myself, so I'm not filing these, but I'm referring to people that are, and it could be years down the road before this actually comes to fruition. A lot of students at this point have been frustrated and just left. If you leave, you don't really have any options, but it's best to stay and fight and do litigation. A lot of people have discussed whether they could just do reinstatements, but that's filing a reinstatement to go before the same agency that just canceled the visa, and it's not clear that a reinstatement would be successful, and that would be 6 to 12 months down the road that you would get a decision on that reinstatement without the ability to go to school. So that's why a lot of people are filing individual lawsuits or actions with other individuals to try to compel the administration to allow the students to continue with their studies.
If that's what the legal community is doing, is there a role that, you know, the more general community can have in trying to support international students? Because not all of us have law degrees.
I think just in general, if you know international students, support them, talk to them, tell them that you're supportive of them, that they're welcome in the country and in the Pittsburgh community. We have a lot of international students here in Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon in particular, University of Pittsburgh, Duquesne, a lot of universities, and we benefit as a city from the universities greatly. And if we don't have international students that are allowed to come here, that's going to be a real problem for those universities, for the city itself. There's going to be a brain drain. A lot of the individuals are coming here and doing STEM fields, and that's much needed in this area.
I mean, speaking of all the international students here at Carnegie Mellon, we've even got Well, the president got a letter from the administration that seemed pretty threatening about it. Are we going to have to cut back on the amount of international students admitted?
I'm aware of that letter. I've read it. I'm not going to comment specifically what CMU should do. But as far as cutting back on international students, they have threatened to cut international students' ability to go to Harvard. If that's successful, if Harvard does not win that, then potentially everybody down the line could have issues with getting federal funding and the ability to actually allow international students. It might not even be a question of whether CMU does it or not. It might be a matter of, will this administration allow them to?
What would you say is the value of having international students? Because to me, the international students are some of the smartest people in my class half the time.
Yep, and my nephew's actually an international student in the UK, or was. He's now living there, but he was an international student in the UK, so a lot of it's reciprocal. Our U.S. citizens that are traveling abroad and studying abroad, are they going to have issues with being allowed to study in those locations or travel? And we're bringing the best and the brightest here to the U.S. to study. I mean, Carnegie Mellon is one of the top in the world for a lot of programs, and they're coming and learning and getting jobs here, and it's going to be a brain drain if we don't allow international students and have a free flow of academia. It's going to be a real problem for industry in years to come. A lot of the people that are in charge of Fortune 500 companies are immigrants. A lot of startups are founded by immigrants. It's going to be a real problem if you don't have immigrants. It's going to drain the U.S. economy. I mean, you look at just half the world's CEOs, it's going to be an issue. I mean, you look at just the administration itself, a lot of them are immigrants themselves. And if you cut that off, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, I'm curious about one thing. What are the constitutional rights of international students when they're studying in the U.S., and how does that differ from citizens?
Well, they should be given due process. Everybody in the U.S. deserves to have due process by being a person that's here in the U.S. So the question is, do they have the same rights to free speech? I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I'm not going to speak to that, other than I would caution people from doing that at this point, just given this administration. You've seen what has been happening to the international students that have been very vocal. Right or wrong, that's an issue that you don't really want to have the administration after you, unless if you want to be a spokesperson or have a target on your back. But they do have rights, to answer your question. International students have rights of due process, just as Americans have rights when we go abroad. You have to be aware of the rights or the laws of the country. That's something to be concerned about. But what is happening, these individuals are not criminals. They're basically, their free speech rights, they should have First Amendment rights. If somebody has a traffic incident, they should be able to resolve that and continue their studies. It should not lead to immigration action where their visas are canceled for a parking ticket or a speeding ticket. DUI is a different matter, but they should be allowed the process of the law in order to continue with that. Obviously, there's visa revocations that were happening. It started under the Obama administration, where if somebody had a DUI, they would revoke the visa, but they were allowed to straighten it out and they were allowed to continue studies, and it was an issue. But what would happen is they just wouldn't leave the U.S. So you don't have full rights of a U.S. citizen, but you do have a lot of rights. And you might want to discuss any situations with an immigration lawyer as far as if you're planning on departing the U.S., ability to return to the U.S. There are guidance as far as electronic devices that you might want to look at, as far as what you can and can't carry and what you should be doing. But obviously you want to abide by the laws of the U.S., but the U.S. does need to grant everybody that's here due process and rights under the law.
So what would be your advice for current international students? Because you said maybe be careful about speaking unless you're willing to take a lot of risk. Do you have other advice?
I mean, caution in travel. What types of, you know, your cell phone, and this is to U.S. citizens as well, your cell phone can be searched at the border. Your computer can be searched at the border. U.S. citizens are guaranteed admission. Lawful permanent residence, it's a little bit dicey. You can be put into removal proceedings, but international students and international visitors, they can be refused admission to the U.S., so that's something to be cautious of. I mean, obviously, everybody wants to go somewhere for spring break. Everybody wants to go see family. But if you're concerned about travel, it's safest not to travel sometimes, especially if you're one semester away, finish your studies. But then the question comes to OPT and STEM OPT, and you hate to have people captive in the U.S. where they can't leave the U.S. But sometimes for international students, it does seem like that the safest approach is not to travel, which is very sad.
Yeah. Is there any other way you should try and be safe? Or do you just try and keep your head down, don't travel, and just hope to continue your studies?
I'd say talk to other people. Make people aware of what you're doing. Have contacts where, you know, people can get a hold of you. Have, you know, if you're picked up by ICE, you should have an immigration attorney that you can contact. Removal defense, there's many good removal defense attorneys in Pittsburgh. I myself don't handle those types of cases, but anybody that has questions, they can certainly contact me, and I can, you know, funnel out to immigration attorneys that might be able to handle those types of situations. But yeah, I would say just make sure that people are aware of, you know, your surroundings, aware of you. You know, if you're, unfortunately, if you're picked up by immigration, you might have to have points of contact in order to navigate the process. Make sure your family knows, you know, how to get a hold of you. Friends know how to get a hold of you.
This is Forbes Avenue. We're interviewing Mark Hurley about immigration law. So I know you're associated with CMU in immigration. What does that look like from your perspective?
We do business-based immigration for the university. There are several attorneys that have been designated to do university work and recommended by the university to do work on behalf of students. So it's a referral list. So it's a pleasure and a privilege to work with CMU and to handle immigration matters for them.
I'm curious about one sort of legal machinery that goes on here. The review process and hearing process for challenging these revocations of visas, does that go through the State Department and the agencies responsible for issuing the visas, or is that through the courts, like a traditional legal case?
Well, right now, SEVIS is just being terminated by ICE. And if you're trying to do anything through ICE or the Department of Homeland Security, it's probably a wasted cause as far as, like I said, the reinstatement, filing those, because it goes to the same agency, USCIS, that is the ones that had done it within the Department of Homeland Security. So ICE ends it, Immigration Customs Enforcement, and you hear before USCIS. So that's why most people are not doing that route. Most people are taking it directly to federal court with a federal judge. So district court judges will be the ones that hear that, potentially up to the circuit court level, and then potentially up to the Supreme Court. So it's in front of federal judges, not immigration judges, federal judges.
What's the difference between an immigration judge and a federal judge? Because I've heard say, you know your rights. If you have a warrant signed by an immigration judge, you don't have to comply necessarily.
Correct.
So what's that difference?
They're within the Department of Justice. They're basically an administrative law judge, whereas a federal judge is sitting within the executive branch. They're not an agency judge as if an immigration judge. An immigration judge works for the agency. They're not an actual judicial official. They are a judge. You have to refer to them as judge, but they're not a federal judge that has the authority to do a lot of the things the federal judges are doing right now to stop some of the actions that the administration is doing.
So under the current law, are visas sort of at will by the executive branch, or do they have to provide some sort of legal reason to revoke them?
They should provide a legal reason to revoke them, but right now that's where a lot of these lawsuits are coming, because they're not doing the actual Procedures Act that they're supposed to be doing. So a lot of these, as we indicated, are being canceled. They are saying that the individual students aren't maintaining status for violations that aren't actually violations or should not be violations. So the termination of a lot of these visas is improper, according to most immigration lawyers. There are proper terminations of, you know, obviously if the person stops going to school, that's a violation of status. If they have jobs that they're not allowed to have, that's a violation of status. Certain crimes are a violation of status. But when is a speeding ticket or a traffic ticket or a disorderly conduct that is never actually a conviction, that's not.
I also hear that a lot of the time people aren't even notified until later that they're getting their status revoked. Is that proper, or is this another way where we're doing shortcuts in ways that might not be?
Yeah, it's not proper. They should be being notified. But obviously, there's gaps in the system. But I know most universities are getting those and letting the students know right away and trying to help the students as much as possible. And I understand that that's what CMU is doing as well, trying to help the students as much as possible. But the administration has handcuffed a lot of the universities as far as what they can do. As I said, they have, you know, some universities were trying to reenter people in I-20s and they were just being canceled. So it's a lot of times it is just litigation that has to take place in order to resolve these issues because the administration is doing improper things.
What's your outlook over the next couple of years of this administration on the topic of revoking visas for international students? Do you think it's going to continue, or do you think this trend will be stopped by the current wave of litigation?
It depends on what the federal judges start doing. If they stop the administration from doing them, if they reinstate the students in the CEVIS, if they say you can't cancel the visas, then the administration will stop. If the federal judges allow it to happen, then it will continue to happen. So, and we'll probably see this over the course of the next few years as far as any minor traffic or any minor criminal encounter is going to lead to issues for an international student.
How does this kind of fall within the larger context of immigration law and how that's changing in the United States?
We've seen a lot of changes from the Biden administration to the Trump 2.0 administration. We've definitely seen a lot more vetting that is, you know, and to me as an immigration lawyer, a lot of it does not make sense. A lot of these things are happening and they're just duplicating efforts. We've been seeing a lot of it's hard to say what exactly, but the due process is one of the biggest issues as far as, immigration saying that they can go into any school, go into any church, go into any place where people are gathered, hospital systems to encounter people and remove them from the U.S. instead of allowing those agencies to just continue to have the, you know, where people can go and get treatment for a illness, where students can be safe in their classroom without intrusion by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So a lot of it is things that in previous administrations were taken for granted. This administration, I understand there is enforcement that has to take place, but there should be proper time and places to do that. And we've seen a lot of that, just the changes within this administration that are very harsh for immigrants as far as the populations are concerned.
So in terms of that larger context of immigration, going into classrooms, going into schools and churches and hospitals, I think that there's also been more immigration control enforcement activity on campus. And there's definitely rumors. So how is that affecting things?
Yeah, I mean, it was the revocation of a ICE memo, a policy memo on sensitive locations, where that's what happened a few, probably about 2 months ago, early in the administration, that they said, ICE said that we're going to take that away. So we're going to go anywhere. And now they are starting to. We've seen activity on college campuses. It's something that we have seen more, but obviously like high school, elementary school, the optics of going into a classroom and picking up a first grader. And they actually have. We've had stories of them interviewing elementary school students and going into classrooms. It's rare, and I don't think they're going to try to do that, but it's just the fact that they can now and are willing to do that is concerning, that they're willing to go and take those steps.
It seems, at least from a non-experienced legal ear such as mine, that many of the things that we take for granted about the immigration system are sort of convention. Do you foresee that a lot of these questions that are coming up now are going to get encoded into law, either in this administration or the next?
I don't know that they will be have significant changes in the law, because immigration law has been the same for a long time. They haven't changed significantly since the 90s and then before that in the 80s. So for the past 30 years, they've done no significant immigration legislation. So I don't know that there's going to be changes in the law. It's just really how the law is interpreted and enforced that we've seen. Now it's a lot harsher than it had been in the past. So I think the last reform was 94, so it's been almost 30 years. But the last was in 1986, there was overhauls. So it's been a long time, and most of the immigration laws are antiquated. They do need updates, but you need compromise and, you know, Congress to act to compromise to pass legislation, and I don't know that we're going to see that anytime soon. They haven't done anything significant in years as far as Congress is concerned.
So given all these laws are so antiquated, is it currently just up to ICE and the administration to interpret them?
Well, that's where the judges come in, and lawsuits by attorneys filing on behalf of their clients to make sure that the government is doing proper due process rights of those individuals and not just making up as they go.
You're basically saying that we're currently making history in terms of how immigration is changing in the United States. So when was the last time that we had such changes? Was it under Obama with like DACA, or was it back, you know, in the 90s? Or has this sort of thing been happening in the background slowly and nobody's noticed until now?
I mean, I think we've always had immigration changes throughout our whole history. We've treated certain populations poorly in the past, not given rights to the Chinese. We had Chinese exclusion acts. We detained Japanese during World War II. We've always had issues with how we've treated certain individuals, and unfortunately now we're doing it again, just not giving due process rights to a lot of individuals. So the law has been, I think, pretty, I mean, they had Immigration Control Acts in the 80s and 94. They had Immigration Control Acts. So they've always been doing those types of things to enforce who can come into the U.S. and who can't. And that's every country's right to do that. It's just the question is, are we doing it properly with due process and our enforcement now?
International students at CMU and universities around the country, I have to assume, are kind of terrified right now of the potential consequences of some of these actions by the administration. What advice do you have to them personally to deal with the situation?
I wish I could give advice. It's hard because I'm not in their position. But I would say have support groups, reach out to the university, tell the university your concerns. Reach out to members of Congress, reach out to the U.S. senators' offices, tell them their concern. Every international student is paying a lot of money to come to school here, paying full tuition, and they're an asset to the community, and they should be heard as far as their fears and their concerns.
All right. We are running a little low on time. Do you have anything else you want to say?
I would say just reach out to an immigration lawyer if you have any concerns, if you want to address immigration issues that you or questions that you have. We can certainly navigate the process, or I can assist in pointing out attorneys that might be able to assist in the process. If you do have one of the revocations, reach out to an attorney right away. There are courses of action you can take through immigration attorneys. I wouldn't say just don't give up. Eventually, I think that things will sort of settle themselves out. Right now, it is a lot of confusion, a lot of unknowing, and I think the best thing you can do is reach out for your friends and family for support, to the university for support, and contact an immigration lawyer if you have any questions.
Thank you so much. This has been Forbes Avenue. I'm Rihanna Duncan, and I have
Arjun Das
here. We're interviewing Mark Hurley about immigration law. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Now, opening the vaults on over 100 years of recorded music history. Welcome to Cruising the Decades Global Edition. One song per decade, 100 years of music in 1 hour. Get ready to go cruising through 100 years of popular music. This is a journey through music history from someone with a rather ridiculous record collection. Here's your host for Cruising the Decades, Brad Savage. Brad Savage.
What a magical gift the radio airwaves are. Let's pick some great songs together. Let's listen to the sounds of history and recorded music coming to life. This is Cruising the Decades, episode number 131, cruisingthedecades.com. I'm Brad Savage, and on today's show, Wanda Jackson goes rockabilly all over the world in 1958, plus a wartime tune of 1942. Let's bring our boys home. A Dutch duo tops the world pop charts in 2003. And a spotlight on one of the great quotable comedy films of the 1980s, centered around the story of one Axel Foley. This is Cruising the Decades. One song per decade. All styles and genres are welcome. And we'll begin well over a century ago. In 1911, one of the many hits by Collins and Harlan, one of the most popular singing duo groups of the early 20th century. This one is called Down on the Brandywine. This is 1911 off of a circular wax cylinder disc recording. Let's crank this thing up and see how it sounds. Collins and Harlan on Cruising the Decades.
Me and my Caroline hand in hand. Down on the Brandywine,
on the Brandywine,
rolling the fragrant meadowland, down where the sunbeams shine, down through the woods where the breezes blow, down where the water lilies grow, singing my love song sweet and low, down on the Brandywine. Oh, Caroline, say you'll be mine. Bells ringing, darkies singing, when to church we go a-swinging. Oh, Caroline, won't that be fine? I'll find a spot to build a cot down on the Brandywine. Be on that flowery shore, down on the Brandywine,
on the Brandywine,
back with my Caroline gal once more, back with my baby mine. She's a-waiting down for me, under the weeping willow tree. Oh, what a jubilee there will be, down on the Brandywine. Oh, Caroline, well, say you'll be mine. Joy bells ringing, darkies singing, when to church we go a-swinging. Oh, Caroline, won't that be fine? I'll find a spot to build a cot down on the Brandywine.
hear the improvements in recording technology and the evolution of musical styles of popular music through the decades and beyond. Over 100 years of music. This is the global edition of Cruisin' the Decades. Broadcast worldwide on AM, FM, and shortwave.
I went home, my gal wouldn't let me in. She said she had to come, had to come back again. Lord, somebody's been using that thing. Somebody's been using that thing. Just as sure as you want. Somebody's been using that thing. From the doctor from getting that thing fixed. Lord, somebody's been using that thing. Somebody's been using that thing. Just to show you fun. Somebody's been using that thing. Now, why I had a gal, she's little and low. She used to let me shake it, but she don't no more. Lord, somebody's been using that thing. Somebody's been using that thing. Just to show you fun. Somebody's been using that thing.
Kind of song right there. That is Al Miller and his Market Street Boys from 1929. You just heard Somebody's Been Using That Thing. A little bit of double entendre going on there, as we find so much in all of these century-old recordings. And this program is all about one song per decade, and all the styles and sounds and genres are represented. That is, if we're doing a good job putting the show together, cruisinthedecades.com. Coming up, we will ask the 60s era question, are you experienced? And we'll go sky high in the 1970s. Now we're up to the 1930s, and a highly prolific, very influential jazz musician and arranger and band leader, and in fact, one of the few black band leaders of the era, alongside Duke Ellington, Fletcher Henderson is considered one of the most significant jazz musicians of all time. He had the nickname Smack Henderson at one point. Why? Because of the smacking sound he made with his lips. This is Fletcher Henderson's orchestra with Shoeshine Boy from 1936 on Cruisin' the Decades.
Working hard all day, shoeshine boy, got no time to play. Every nickel counts a lot, so shoeshine, shoeshine boy. You find joy in the things you do, shoeshine boy, seldom every blue. You're content with what you've got, So shine, shine, shoe shine, boy. Now people look, you was gone, cause you closed on, boy, you never seem to mind. You keep strolling down the street, saying to everyone you meet, buddy, can you spare a shine? Daddy, shoe shine, boy, soon the day will come. Shoe shine, boy, soon a tune you'll hum. Every nickel helps along. So shine, shine, shoe shine, boy.
Show that spotlights a love of all genres of music and sharing that eclectic music over the airwaves everywhere. This is Cruisin' the Decades with over 100 years of music on like-minded radio outlets everywhere. Stations that value music and community. There's something special about radio and signals over the air. One broadcast to an audience of many simultaneously. A shared listening experience. Radio and 100 years of music. This is Cruisin' the Decades, Global Edition.
The ship ships will sail again all over the world. Then we'll have time for things like wedding rings, and free hearts will sing when the lights go on again. All over the
voice of Vaughn Monroe, one of the most successful chart hit artists of the 1940s and 50s. Dozens of top 10 songs. Vaughn Monroe with a 1942 wartime tune, When the Lights Go On Again, All Over the World. Probably one of the biggest singers of the 1940s. And we do one song per decade here on cruisinthedecades.com. You can find all of our playlists at cruisinthedecades.com. Up next is a song from Wanda Jackson in the early rock and roll and rockabilly years. Now, this was a 1958 song that, interestingly, some of her managers and team at Capitol Records wanted this to be a big song, and they urged her to release it. Now, she didn't want to because of the references to Japan and the atom bomb destruction. However, it became a global hit, a huge hit in Japan, and she ended up touring in Japan in the late 1950s. This is Wanda Jackson. It's called Fujiyama Mama. It's from 1958 on Cruisin' the Decades.
I've been to Nagasaki, Hiroshima too. The same I did to them, baby. Fujiyama, yama, Fujiyama. And when I start erupting, ain't nobody gonna make me stop. I drink a quart of sake, smoke dynamite. I chase it with the baccy and then shoot out the light. Cause I'm a Fujiyama mama and I'm just about to blow my top. Fujiyama, yama, Fujiyama. I
audio journey, song by song, through every genre of popular music and recorded music history, from swing, jazz, folk, and blues, and the Great American Songbook, to punk, new wave, garage, and alternative. This is the global edition of Cruisin' the Decades with Brad Savage. 100 years of music, one song per decade.
Decades, 100 years of music, one song per decade with the Jimi Hendrix Experience from the first studio album released in August of 1967. Are You Experienced? That was Can You See Me? And we're going to hang out now in the 1960s for a bonus track. We'll go two albums forward and just a year and a half in the chronology, because the only thing better than a Jimi Hendrix song is a second Jimi Hendrix song on Cruisin' the Decade.
Your back, I can see you had your fun, but